Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here on the show today. We're going to explore the health of our Wisconsin waterways from a couple different angles. At 11:45, we're going to talk about mercury pollution with a scientist. And concentrations of mercury in our water have decreased, but there are some wildlife that are showing increased levels of mercury poisoning. Others are dropping, but some are showing increased level. Find out what's being done about that. First, though, we sure hear a lot about the devastating impacts of invasive wildlife on our native ecosystems. Asian carp comes to mind pretty quickly. Getting into the Great Lakes, that's a source of great concern. Zebra mussels sort of, you know, has been long been a concern. My first guest today say prolific invasives are kind of more the exception than they are the rule, I think. That's what they're saying anyway. We're happy to welcome Gretchen Hansen, fisheries research scientist at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Gretchen, thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
Jake Vanderzanden is a professor at the Center for Limnology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Jake, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
I'm really glad to have you here because the research kind of goes against, in some ways, what we've sort of just assumed, what people assumed. Gretchen, your research challenges that notion that invasives are going to take over any habitat. Let's start with sort of a description of your study. What were you really looking at? What species and generally what'd you find?
Sure. Yeah, we were really interested in examining that conventional wisdom that you talk about of invasive species as species that always take over or dominate the places that they invade. So we set out to see if that was true, and we looked at 16 different invasive species, all aquatic species, in lakes and in streams around the world. And we found that if you look at them in a large number of places, so if you sample a whole lot of lakes or a whole lot of streams and see how many are there, in most of those places, they are at really low abundance. And in just a few places, they get to these really high numbers and really dominate. And in this way, they really play by the same rules as native species. This pattern of only being abundant in a few places has been well known for native species for a century in ecology. So we found that invasive species really, in general, followed those same patterns.
So, Jake, the conditions have to be exactly almost perfect for that to happen? Or?
Yeah, that's sort of the normal situation for any species. A species has to have a set of conditions, biological and chemical and physical conditions, in order for it to become really abundant. And typically, things don't all just line up perfectly to allow a normal, typical native species to take off. So that's something that ecologists have known for a long time. Now, we ask the question of, well, does that same set of constraints, the same idea, apply to invasives? And what we found was that, for the most part, it does.
Hmm. How did you do that? I mean, how did you conduct the research, Gretchen? That's interesting.
Yeah, well, this study was actually, we brought together a whole lot of researchers, at the time I was in Jake's lab doing my PhD, and we brought in other postdocs and students in his lab and collaborators we had in other places. So we used data that had already been collected for other studies and just compiled it in this new way.
And looked at it in a totally different way than it had been looked at before.
Right.
Very cool. I want to give our listeners a chance to join in, by the way. I haven't given that number yet, so let me do it right now. You may have a question for our guests today. Are you concerned about invasive species? Does this, maybe this study might change your outlook? What about whether or not we should, how should we respond to invasive species? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You could also email us at talk@WPR, or, of course, you can always post on my Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show. And we've got some more information relating to the study up on my Facebook page, so you can go click there, and we'll send you right to where the research is reported on that Gretchen and Jake have worked on. So again, 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. You mentioned rules that I thought, well, it's kind of interesting. They're playing by the same ecological rules, the non-natives as the natives. What are the rules?
Well, the rules would be just kind of what Jake was talking about, that conditions, a whole combination of conditions have to line up just right in order for a species to really reach its peak abundances. They have to have the right prey, they have to have the right chemical conditions, the right temperature, the right habitat, not too many predators, all these things have to line up. And so that doesn't happen altogether in very many places, and that's why most of the time species are not at really high abundances.
Well, what about, you know, we hear about Asian carp taking over the waterways or zebra mussels being a real problem in the Great Lakes. Are these invasives not problems?
That's a really key point, because I think the one thing we want people to understand is that we're not saying that these species are not a problem. It's just that there's a little bit more nuance in the situation. The point is that they become really abundant in a small number of places. One thing that we don't know is, at those lower or middle abundances, are they having ecological impacts? So this sort of question then brings the new question of how much invasive species do you need to have in a place for there to be, you know, measurable real impacts? Of course, even if there's one zebra mussel in a lake, right around it, it'll probably have an impact, but it won't have an ecosystem-wide impact that's really going to affect anything. So where is that threshold between no impact and impact? And that's sort of the next question that we're Gretchen and I are trying to figure out.
I think in one of the papers you used the example of rusty crayfish as an invasive, where you might find 6 crayfish that are local or natives and 13 or 19 that are rusties.
Yeah.
Is that a problem?
Right.
And there's twice as many or three times as many.
Right. And we don't really know the answer to that for most invasive species. We don't know what is the threshold above which they're going to have these impacts. So as Jake said, we're definitely not saying that they're not a problem, just that maybe there are certain places where the abundance is really high. The impacts are probably highest in those places, but that doesn't really tell us much about what the impacts are in the other places, because we don't know.
Yeah, and so the money that we're spending to kind of keep Asian carp out is probably a good thing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think anytime you can prevent an invasive species from getting into a new place, it's money really well spent. The problem is when something is already here, by that point, it's often too late to do very much, and that's usually when people get really concerned about an invasive species, is after it's already arrived. That's prevention, keeping them out of the Great Lakes, is absolutely a top priority.
Is there, I don't know if there's any difference between the way an invasive aquatics inhabit an area as opposed to a land species?
That's a great question. And as I said, in this study, we were only looking at aquatic species. So some of the land-based invasives that you might think of as getting really abundant, like garlic mustard or kudzu, we didn't include that in our study. So we don't know. It would be a great question to follow up of, do they follow these same patterns that we saw?
God, kudzu. Do we have kudzu yet in Wisconsin? Has it arrived anywhere?
Not that I know of. I'm not an expert on terrestrial plants. We got our hands full with aquatic ecosystems here.
I was just flashing back to driving through Georgia.
Right.
And taking a look at the kudzu and thinking, oh, please never let it come to Wisconsin.
There may be some species that are an exception to this pattern that we're seeing. Kudzu might be one of them. But it may be that even though you see kudzu taking over a lot of places, there are a lot of other places where they're sort of at low levels. So I don't know. I mean, it's a...
You know, my guess is if it stays as cold as a normal winter here is probably going to not be very good for kudzu.
Very true. But invasive species are very unpredictable. A really good example is water celery, which is a wetland plant. It's also known as Vietnamese parsley. And this was a species that was not supposed to do well in this climate. And about 2 years ago, they just took off like wildfire in, they escaped from people's water gardens and took off like wildfire in some ditches near Broadhead, Wisconsin, just south of here in Madison. So, you know, here's some examples of species that you don't think are going to make it, but they do amazingly well.
Yeah. And there's so many species that we brought in for one reason. And what happens is that it's supposed to control something, and in the end, it creates way more problems than if we just left well enough alone.
Sure.
Very true. We're really good at moving things around. I mean, you know, there's the hitchhikers, and then there are the things that we move intentionally as well.
Yeah. Gretchen Hansen, fisheries research scientist in the Bureau of Science Services at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, one of our guests, the other, Jake VanderZanden, professor at the Center for Limnology at the UW-Madison, talking with them today about invasive species and their work on it and their view on invasive species and their spread. You may have a question or comment. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or you can post on my Facebook page. Just go to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller. Cynthia Schuster, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So happy to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here taking a look at invasive species, aquatic invasives, with our two guests who've done a lot of research in this area, Gretchen Hansen of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and Jake VanderZanden, professor at the Center for Limnology at the UW-Madison as well. That center is a really cool place. They've done some really fascinating research I've been able to talk about over the years, and this is just one more of those great research projects. Again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Michael on Facebook writes, I think a more nuanced view of invasive species is in order. Most of the areas I think of as invasive nightmare, in kind of in quotes, aren't that way because of the foreign invaders. They're in bad shape because the native ecosystems that used to be there were destroyed or disturbed, and the exotic species are taking their place. So that's, so, you know, how would you respond to that? Is that a statement that...
I'm sorry, can you repeat it again?
Yeah, it's, Michael just wrote that he thinks a more nuanced view of invasive species is in order. Most of the areas he thinks of as invasive nightmare aren't that way because of foreign invaders. They're in bad shape because the native ecosystem that used to be there was destroyed or disturbed, and the exotic species are taking their place.
Sure. Yeah, that's a pretty prominent theory in invasive species, that some of the species that become invasive are ones that are really able to take advantage of disturbed conditions. So the conditions that might be right for them are places where maybe some of the natives have been wiped out because of excessive nutrients or loss of habitat or things like that. So that's definitely an issue, that increased disturbance can increase the likelihood of having really abundant invasives.
Yeah, I think so. Jake, comment from you?
No, I
definite agreement.
Oh, I absolutely agree. Gretchen and I agree on a lot of things. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's part of the bigger picture of how we change our landscape. And one example that comes to mind is that research that we did a few years ago found that impounded water bodies, so in other words, mm-hmm. a lake that's created by a dam built by humans, has more invasive species than natural lakes. Mm-hmm. So just an example of how, you know, it's sort of connected to the bigger picture. And when we alter the landscape, sometimes we pave the way for these invasives.
To come up. Mona in Madison, I'm going to give you a chance. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, how are you? This is very interesting to me, having just come up from Tennessee, where kudzu was intentionally imported. Can you give an example of an aquatic species that was intentionally imported and the consequences and the reasons why?
Sure. Jake, I bet you...
I got a few of them, but one interesting one that comes to mind are the Asian carp species. They were actually brought to North America intentionally to be used in aquaculture ponds. They're really good at cleaning up the scum in these aquaculture ponds. So they were brought here, and they were used in those ponds like starting around the 1970s. Well, they ended up escaping. And, you know, they were formerly contained in these ponds. They managed to get out during some sort of a flood condition, and then they slowly colonized their way up the Mississippi River to the point now where they're knocking on the door of the Great Lakes, and some people believe that they are now starting to get into the Great Lakes. So, you know, there's a lot of species that we brought over here intentionally, but there's a lot of them that have made it here accidentally as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Mona. Tom in Nina, it's your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hi there. First of all, you know, I really appreciate the program, and I believe we need to follow the direction of science and try to keep the emotional piece of it out of it. But I think a lot of us can't separate, because emotionally involved in what's happening to our natural areas. Just recently, within the last 2 weeks, it's been verified that the New Zealand mud snail now has been found in a trout stream right outside of Madison. And as you probably are aware,
Black Earth Creek.
Right. They were first introduced into North America in 1987 or something, and now they're here in Wisconsin, and they are such an extremely small mollusk that it's, you know, it's even, if you looked on your equipment, it's hard to even see it. So I guess, what do your experts there believe the impact now is going to be on Wisconsin's trout streams, and in particular, we have world class trout streams in southwestern Wisconsin, and I guess I'm really concerned about what's happened.
Yeah, I don't blame you, Tom. Gretchen, have you comments?
Sure. Yeah, this is a big issue being talked about in the DNR right now. And as far as what are the impacts going to be on the trout streams, we really don't know. New Zealand mud snails have been in western trout streams for a couple decades now, and there's some evidence that they can have negative effects on trout and their growth and their body condition, but we don't know for sure about that. But we do know they can really get to really high densities. That has been seen with these species, really ridiculous densities, like 500,000 per square meter.
My goodness.
And in doing so, they can just dominate the stream bottom. So all the native species that used to live there, the native snails, the native bugs, are pretty much displaced by these New Zealand mud snails, which are not as palatable for trout. They can actually, up to 50 to 80% of them can pass through trout undigested. So they're not as good of a food source. So there is a cause for concern. But so this is an example of, we know they're in one place right now, and this is an example where prevention and really diligence on the part of the Wisconsin people is going to be important to try to prevent spreading them to other places while we kind of get a handle on what's happening.
Now, how would something like, let's use that mud snail as an example. And you're absolutely right, prevention. If we can prevent them in the first place, that is really the key. But how does something like a New Zealand mud snail wind up in Black Earth Creek in southern Wisconsin?
Well, I think the best guess, these species are very easily spread. I think the best guess is through waders or boots of some kind, that if it was identified that this was the strain of the species that was from out west. So somebody goes fishing in Montana, they can live out of the water for up to 40 days. So you throw your waders in your car, you come back, 2 weeks later you go fishing on Black Earth Creek, and there they are. So,
The other thing about New Zealand mud snail is that they're so small. I mean, when I was first shown New Zealand mud snail, my response was, "Where are they? I don't see them. They're tiny." Yeah. And I think, you know, just emphasizing that point of prevention is key. Now, at this point, they're in this one site in Wisconsin, and I think one thing we need to ask is whether maybe trying to eradicate them using some sort of chemical treatment would be the way to go, because that's essentially preventing them from spreading. But right now, anglers, fishermen who are going in the water need to make sure that they're not spreading these things around from place to place.
And so something like that, just as an aside, I mean, there's a lot of trout fishermen who listen to this program. If you've been now in Black Earth Creek, you want to make sure that you, clean those waders and...
Clean them really well. Really the best way to get rid of them is to allow your waders to completely dry in a warm environment, so they're totally dry for several days. Or freezing them can also work, so come winter, that might be a way. The DNR is currently working on guidance for anglers of really what they should do, because they are so easily spread in such a hardy and small species. They are pretty difficult.
Yeah.
And there's another, if I could make one more comment about it. Another point that I'm sure the DNR and Trout Unlimited and other nature organizations are considering, you can put cleaning stations at access points to the affected area. And I know that they have to be maintained, but I think this is probably a significant enough situation that the presence of cleaning stations not only help to prevent the spread, but they communicate the importance of the issues that we're facing.
Yeah, and that's definitely being considered, and just the outreach is a big part of the response, is letting people know that they're there and what they can do to prevent their spread, and wash stations are certainly an option at this point.
And Jake, you had talked earlier about targeting, and in a case, and this is, again, maybe a good example of discussing that further. If you've got a situation where it's really ripe for an explosion of something, targeting your money and your time in a specific spot.
Well, yeah, and when an invasive species just shows up, like what we have here with New Zealand mud snail, that's the time to really target it. Now, the question is, can you want to contain it, and if possible, you want to try to knock out the population. A really good example of this is the red swamp crayfish, which was found in three ponds in the Milwaukee Kenosha area. And the DNR responded. They realized, okay, this is a new species that's only in three ponds. It's potentially really harmful, and this is one that I had really worried about. And so DNR has successfully knocked out two of those populations through a lot of work. And they're in the process of trying to knock out the third one, which is near Germantown. So, you know, when they get in, you may have to put a lot of money in to eradicate those populations, but it's money well spent because you nip the problem at the bud. Otherwise, they're just going to continue to spread.
Well, compared to what you'd have to spend down the road.
It's
peanuts.
We don't want another Eurasian water milfoil, which now we're spending millions of dollars treating lakes and all sorts of projects trying to control them. And one last thing, Tom, I'm from Nina originally, so I appreciate it. Hearing from you, so.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate the call. Gary in Washburn, I want to give you a chance. Hi, Gary.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Sure.
I've worked on research vessels. I retired recently for 22 years on Lake Superior, and I've observed firsthand a lot of these newcomers to the lake. And the thing we've seen over time is that the native populations tend to adapt to the invasive after a while, after there's an initial boom in the population. And they adapt to its presence. And a lot of the control things, for example, sea lamprey, buy the native population's time to adapt to the presence of the invader. Once the genie's out of the bottle, it's really hard to put them back in.
Yeah. Thanks for calling. And Jake, comment?
Yeah, Gary, those are great observations. I think that's sort of the reality in that, I mean, our world is, you know, here in the state of Wisconsin, is being filled with invasive species. And if we want our native species that we value to be able to continue, they're going to have to adapt to the fact that our lakes, rivers, and land are increasingly filled with invasive species. And that there are a lot of examples, you know, aside from in Lake Superior, whereby the invasive species do manage to coexist with natives. But I think, you know, these control efforts often do buy a little bit of time. And you know, we have a lot of examples from our research where we've seen the same thing. We hope that the native species are able to adapt quickly enough. That's really the challenge, because these invasives are coming fast and furious.
Yeah. Yep, they are. Thanks, Gary. I appreciate the call. Barbara in Green Bay. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Thank you for answering. This isn't quite the invasive species in the water. I'm concerned about that farm. I can't pronounce it.
Oh, Phragmites?
Phragmites. I was just overtaking around the streams and choking out lowlands. And why, like, when highway construction goes through, it seems like the DNR doesn't work with the highway department to eliminate it.
Mm.
Stand in the highway construction areas.
All right. Well, let's. Gretchen, you want to comment?
I think Jake had a comment.
Sure. I want to. I don't want to. You know, have Gretchen comment on this because it's about the DNR. So, I mean, yeah, Phragmites. I've been noticing that cropping up in ditches along the highway, like like crazy lately. And once you start looking for Phragmites, you see that it is really, really widespread. I think this is an example of where, you know, partnerships working together is really, really important because, you know, the DNR has one set of objectives, the highway departments may have others. And I think over time, what we see is that people realize that they have these common objectives like, you know, stopping or preventing the spread of Phragmites, and these are the sorts of things that we need to do. I'm not sure why they're not working together at this point. I don't really know much about that issue.
They may be working together.
Yeah.
Actually, it's possible, but there's just so much of it out there. I have some friends who have some property with, and there's Phragmites along their whole stretch and past their property and on. Their property looks very, very interesting because they went in and cleaned it all out. And then they come in regularly and pick anything new that's coming. And so you'll see a whole area of Phragmites, boom, nothing for their property line. And then on the other side of the property line starts up again. So it also shows that, you know, we can, you know, personally, we can do some things to kind of, at least if everybody helped their own area, it would have an impact, I would think, Gretchen.
Sure, yeah. But as your example shows, it does take a lot of effort to control these things once they're there and they're really abundant. It takes kind of constant diligence. And I think the sea lamprey example that was brought up before is another one that once these invasive species are there, it's kind of constant maintenance, spending money every year. Eurasian water milfoil is another example of trying to keep their numbers at least depressed to a place that we find to be a better situation. So again, that emphasizes why preventing them from getting there in the first place is probably a better use of resources.
Yeah, absolutely. Barb, thank you for calling. Nancy in Grafton, thank you for calling. Hi.
Good morning. I live here in Grafton, and we have the Milwaukee River. Well, the dam. We have a dam here that used to make electricity years and years and years ago. So the people voted and they decided to keep the dam, redo the dam, put a fish ladder in the dam. You look up the river and you see all this green algae because the water is sitting there and it's not flowing. This is costing thousands and thousands of dollars. And I just want to know, is there any sense in putting fish ladders in and spending all that kind of money to keep a dam, because some people along the river thought that they made their property more valuable.
Mm. Yeah, the dam removal issue is a pretty complex one, and invasive species are just one of the considerations that goes into those kinds of decisions. And being a dam on the Milwaukee River that is connected to the Great Lakes, we do know there are hundreds of aquatic invasives in Lake Michigan, and some of those are capable of moving themselves upstream if they have unrestricted access. So that is one reason that people want to keep dams in, is to keep invasives out of the streams. But there are, as you say, a lot of other issues that go into that.
Yeah, I want to emphasize just the ecological harm that having dams in rivers can do. I mean, this is not a hydro dam, so there's no real use for it. So I think you have to sort of counterbalance the invasive prevention role that a dam could play versus just the impacts that it has on the water body. And in this case, you say that impoundment is green and nasty. And, you know, I think in a lot of cases, people don't want to remove dams because the dam has been there for a long time and they like it. But the studies that have looked at the property values have found that really removing a dam doesn't reduce property values at all. And there have been several studies, including right here in Wisconsin, that have asked that question, and they didn't find that a dam removal causes your property value to go down.
Yeah. So. But there's that fear, and, you know, if you own a property, I mean, you say your house is right on the edge of the lake or the pseudo lake, you're going to fight. A lot of people are going to fight it. Thanks again for calling. Larry in Wauwatosa, turning to you next. Thank you for calling.
Hi, good morning. Hi, Gretchen. I think you know my son, Eric. He worked with you up at Trout Lake.
Oh, yeah.
You both know him.
Yeah.
How's he doing?
he'll be listening to the podcast tomorrow.
Oh, great.
I guess I had two things. One, I am a fly fisherman and a fisherman, so the invasive species from New Zealand are of interest. Eric was in New Zealand last year.
Uh-oh.
The thing that I thought was very interesting is that New Zealand is very, very strict on letting invasive species into the country, so they check all the gear, including the fly lines and the lures and everything, to make sure that they're clean before they come into the country. We don't do that here. I think that would be a great idea. Second thing I had was on the round goby. It was a question, and I've heard different stories about how the impact of the round goby was or is in Lake Michigan, how it was decimating the perch population. But then I heard that the perch were adapting and is now starting to eat the round goby or the round goby eggs. Is there any truth to that?
Okay, Gretchen?
Yeah, well, I'll take a stab at the first point about New Zealand and their strict control measures. I think in New Zealand, because they have so many endemic species, so species that only live in New Zealand and nowhere else, that have been really, really negatively affected by invasives, they have taken a very strong stance against letting them in. And I think that is a good point, that there are some things that we could do and be a little bit more diligent about to try to prevent the spread, and things like, you know, removing all plant matter from your boat trailer or really washing your waders thoroughly and letting them dry out. These are things that every person can do that could really help out with this problem. But at this point, it hasn't been as strictly enforced as it has in place like New Zealand. And yeah. I think Jake could probably comment on the goby.
For gobies, gobies are part of the story in the nearshore areas of Lake Michigan. The shallow areas of Lake Michigan have been fully remodeled over the last 20 years. As zebra mussels came in, they cleared the water. Zebra mussels are the one species that round goby really like to eat. So when round goby were introduced into the Great Lakes, they found zebra mussels there. They're both from the Caspian Sea and in Central Asia. So gobies show up and they have this amazing food source. So gobies start to do really well. And they're feeding on zebra mussels. And zebra mussels did a really good job of clearing the water. So the bottom of the lake started getting overgrown with this native algae. It's the stringy green snot-like algae. It's called Cladophora. And that's something that grows in these gigantic mats in the shallow waters. And then late in the summer, it sort of kind of comes unattached to the bottom and it washes up on the shore. So Lake Michigan now is just completely different from what it was 30 years ago. Round gobies are part of that story. There is some sign of adaptation, and some of these species, one really good example is Lake Whitefish, a really important commercially valuable fishery. We're finding that they are feeding heavily on little round gobies now. So round gobies are so abundant, they're really one of the few food items out there. Any species that is capable of feeding on zebra mussels or round gobies, if they can pull it off, they'll do pretty well.
Very interesting. Larry, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it very much. Can we predict which invasives will or won't pop up in higher densities? You know, how can you tell what to look out for?
This is a really good question. We want to be able to do that. If we could say, all right, here are some sites that we think the invasive species are going to take over. They'll become really abundant there. And here are some other sites where we think they'll get in, but they'll just sort of stay at lower levels. If we could do that, that would be really great. Doing that is really hard. And I think even if we could do it, we wouldn't be able to do it with 100% accuracy. But at least we could say, well, this one's more likely to be taken over. This one isn't. That's really, I think, the next big challenge for our field, is to try to find ways to be really predictive. In the past, people have focused on, okay, which species are going to have a big impact. Mm-hmm. But now we're sort of unpacking that and we're saying, okay, we know what species we're talking about. Now, for that particular species, which sites are going to be impacted? Yeah. So it's very spatial.
And assessing of how well you do is a problem too, because if you put in preventive measures, you don't know for sure if they would have cut, you know, and nothing happens.
Right. You don't know if
you can't measure it.
Because
yeah.
of what you did.
How do you measure that?
You were so successful because nothing happened.
Right.
But prediction in this area is so difficult. I had worked with some of my students to develop a model of which lakes were going to be invaded by this new invasive species called spiny water flea. It's really nasty and so on. And this model had said that spiny water flea would not survive in Lake Mendota because Lake Mendota was too murky. It likes clear water. several months after we developed that model, I'm out with my students from my limnology class, and we're taking plankton samples. So we're dragging these big plankton nets through the water column, and the students pull this sample out, hand it to me, and it's just teeming with spiny water fleas. And of course, I went crazy because they weren't supposed to be here. So this is just a sort of reminder of how difficult it can be to predict these things.
Well, let's just sort of, and by way of summary or just looking ahead maybe in a way, how do you think plant and wildlife management should adapt in light of your study's conclusions, maybe to sort of summarize everything here?
Yeah, I think the biggest impact it could have on management is in allocating resources once species are already there, once they're established. So we still think prevention is the key. Prevention is the number one thing we should be focusing on. But once a species gets in, an invasive species is there, and we have a number of sites that are invaded, and we only have a limited amount of resources we can use to try to manage them, maybe we should focus on these hot spots, these few sites where the invasives are going to have the highest abundance, in terms of controlling and managing those to get the biggest bang for our buck.
Yeah, well, and you're in total agreement with that one.
I agree, yeah. I mean, it's really about sort of, I mean, you can step back, and it's helpful if we can, you know, use this information and choose our battles a little bit better, focusing on the place where we get the most bang for our buck. And I think that's what we all want. We want the resources that we expend addressing this issue to be spent in a way that is getting the most for the money. It's about good value in the sort of the taxpayer money that goes into this issue.
Yeah, absolutely. And your paper, I think we've got a link to it on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Otherwise, it's available, I'm sure, through the DNR and through your site as well, Jake.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And the title of that, remember the title? What's the title of it? It's
Commonly Rare and Rarely Common, Comparing Population Abundance of Invasive and Native Aquatic Species.
Ah, there we go.
It's a classic.
Yeah.
It's a classic. Thank you, Jake. Thank you, Gretchen. And I hope we have a chance to meet again, maybe either on this topic or some other ones.
That'd be great.
I'd be happy to.
Yeah, I'd love to have you back. It was a lot of fun, and I learned a bit here, and I hope you did too as you listened in. Gretchen Hansen is a fisheries research scientist in the Bureau of Science Services at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, Jake Vander Zanden, professor at the Center for Limnology at the University of Wisconsin, Madison. Great to have them with us, and it was really fun to talk about interesting to talk about invasives. Well, you know what? We got something else in our Wisconsin waters that's not so much fun. That's mercury. But we have a great research group looking at mercury in our Wisconsin waters, and you're going to hear some more about that coming up next on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.